When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great-tasting, high-quality organic dairy ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 149. I've been in London for a couple of days, so I've decided to absorb the accent like so many people do when they come over here, so I can take it home and annoy my friends. Hello, then!
I'm not really going to do that, but sometimes people do. They do. They go for like a week, and they come back, and they're like, what, sorry, I've been in London. I get it. You want to show me that you travel. You win.
I don't know why I chose that particular one, which made me sound like a British morning DJ.
Danny Minogue coming up right after the break. Make sure and come out this weekend to see me DJ at the Tube Station. I'll be opening for the Mamby Pambies.
And scene. Anyway, here's some fun stuff. We're about to record our second Nerdist stand-up comedy special, which is going to be at Meltdown Wednesday, the 14th of December, in just a couple days from the time this podcast goes live. And join us there. We're taking over Kumail and Jonah's regular Wednesday night Meltdown show to record an incredible group of stand-up comics who you may or may not have heard of, but hopefully you will know them after the special, because that's how events work and the direction of time. Well said. Also, the Nerdist Podcast Live is going on the road a lot. We have a ton of dates for next year and a bunch more coming in. Notably, January 6th, we're going to be at the 930 Club in D.C. and then the 28th as part of SF Sketchfest. Then there's a bunch of other dates coming up in February and March and April, probably May, and then possibly June, and then who knows, July, and then could be August, maybe September, October, I don't know, November, who knows? Go to Nerdist.com/calendar to get info on that stuff as well. This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by
Saints Row the Third.
I know, awesome sponsor on the Nerdist Podcast. Yeah, let's get some games in here for crap's sake. It's about time. This is an amazing game. It is the biggest, I'm going to say most over-the-top guilty pleasure in gaming, available on Xbox 360, PlayStation 3, and PC. You get complete control of the Saints at the height of their power. You live the life to show for it. Steelport is ripe for the taking. It is up to you to make the city your own. Mold the skyline based on your choices. Outfit your crew in classy gangster gear or furry costumes if you want. Make life or death decisions that will change Steelport and the Saints forever. This is your city, people. By the way, side note, this game is freaking hilarious. So if you have not played any of the Saints Rows, how many of the Saints Row games should you be playing? All of them. But now you can play Saints Row the Third. So I'd like to thank them for being a sponsor of the Nerdist Podcast, which this episode, guys, seriously, guys, if I could take an episode on a date and stare into its eyes longingly while I pretend to eat linguine and covering the boner in my lap with a cloth napkin, the Nerdist Podcast episode number 149 with J.J. Abrams, who, by the way, was so gracious. We went, Jonah, Ray, and I, Matt had to work, but Jonah and I went over to Bad Robot, which is an incredible facility. And he just sat down and talked to us, just like a person. I mean, I get he's a human being, but I don't know. I'm just a big fan, and so I nerd out on people, as I know that you know. So it was really, it's always a wonderful surprise when you get to sit down and talk to someone whose work you respect and who you've liked for a long time, and
You just feel like, holy shit, I could just fucking hang out with this person. Special Abrams side note, Super 8 is now available on DVD, Blu-ray, and for digital download, so pick that up. And now I shall refold myself into the dense London night, and I say to you, good listeners, pip with an additional and redundant pip.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Talk at a normal level there, J-Rick.
Hey, what do you think about if I got some of that bottle of water and put it into my cup here? Okay, it's just say I didn't get offered.
It was there. You could have gotten it.
Well, I didn't feel like asking if it wasn't offered. It's rude of me.
I gotta be honest, this is the best water I've ever had.
It looks like it. I mean, the clarity of it is just...
It's refreshing, and it's like drinking diamonds.
Mm-hmm.
It's really good.
You see, now it doesn't seem like that sounds good at all.
My throat!
Yeah.
Why?
Alas, ye blood diamond.
I just started recording.
Now?
Yeah, why not?
That's true.
We're in the theater at Bad Robot.
How about the amount of awesome stuff that was downstairs?
There's such crazy memorabilia downstairs.
Here's what happened when we were downstairs. There's robots everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a toy robot that I had as a kid that I had completely forgotten the existence of. And it blew my mind. My mind was blown downstairs because it opened up. I don't know when I had it. I don't know when it came out. But there was a robot down there that I used to own and play with all the time.
Do you think that was yours? Do you think in a weird time loop, JJ went back in time to your childhood, took your robot, placed it right there so it would have some sort of a larger meaning?
Did he take the memory too? Because I'm still having a hard time trying to...
A little bit. Yeah. Well, when he ruptured the time vortex, it fucked with your memory a little bit.
My dad ruptured his time vortex once. He's bedridden for weeks.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you have to get a transfusion?
It's a mass confusion.
Here's some water. Now shut up.
Oh, I should have drank more of the coffee taste out of it. But there was a lot of Twilight Zone stuff. There was a Twilight Zone or pinball, which is one of my favorite.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm gonna definitely talk to him about the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, and then there's what else did we see down there? Oh, a bust of, I guess it's not a bust. Simon Pegg.
That is a bust.
That's what a bust is.
Yeah.
I thought a bust was the one at the Steve Allen Theater, Steve Allen, where it's like a, you know, made out of iron or something.
It's made out of solid iron.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Steve Allen is Iron Man.
He is pretty awesome.
Hey, Jarvis, let's go out on the street and interview somebody. Little microphone from the suit pops out.
You ever see the Steve Allen clip where he has Frank Zappa on, and Zappa doesn't have a mustache or like long hair? He's just kind of this like clean cut guy, and he's just showing Steve Allen how to make music out of a bicycle.
Mm-mm.
It's pretty. Look up Steve Allen, Frank Zappa.
On what? In an encyclopedia? I should go to the library and look it up?
Just go to http://www.google.com.
Sounds like future talk.
/search.
I'll just put it into Google and then hit, I'm feeling lucky. I don't think they took that button away, I think.
Did they?
Well, because it just auto suggests.
Yeah, that's true.
So you don't have to feel lucky anymore. Google makes you lucky.
Did you see they have they have all those Easter eggs now where it's like you put in barrel roll and it flips the screen?
Yeah.
That was good.
That's fun stuff.
It is. I like little fun stuff.
What do you want to screen in this theater?
Honestly, I want to screen Creepshow 2. I want to get a bunch of people
Part
together.
Part 2?
Yeah, I think it's better than Creepshow 1.
What?
Yeah, come on. You got the wooden Indian.
Yeah, but Creepshow 1 had Leslie Nielsen and Ted Danson and the crazy,
it's great. But, as a whole, like, I think I like the three stories in Creepshow 2 better.
And E.G. Marshall with the cockroaches?
Yeah, but Creepshow 2 has the raft.
Yeah, but Creepshow 1 has E.G. Marshall saying, go out and get fucked, but wear a rubber. There's too much goddamn herpes going around these days.
Yeah, but Creepshow 2 has thanks for the ride, lady. Dover or bust.
Thanks for the ride,
lady. Which is something I say to my friends every time I leave a car and getting a ride.
Thanks
for the ride, lady.
Damn. Yeah, that's true. Creepshow 2 was pretty good.
Yeah.
Someone needs to make a good, like, anthology movie.
You know, there's been a lot of direct-to-video or direct-to-insta-watch kind of stuff going on lately, and none of them are good.
Fuck.
That's what disappoints me, like, and that's why...
Are we going to have to do this?
I think so.
Okay.
Well, it's because there's no Tales from the Dark Side right now. There's no Tales from the Crypt.
Wouldn't it be funny if JJ had been here the whole time, but you were just having this conversation? Oh, JJ.
Yeah.
No, he's on his way.
I'm pretty sure because we didn't bring it up, people would be like, why don't they let him talk?
He's so clearly sitting right there.
He can't get a word in edgewise.
You guys interrupt everyone.
Yeah. But yeah, I want there to be new, like, horror shows like that.
I'm surprised with our, like, YouTube culture and short attention spans that there aren't more film collections of anthologies, like a really good,
yeah,
creepy stories.
Well, it's, you know, the weird thing is I think Tales from the Crypt kind of, it made fun of the horror movie host kind of thing.
Yeah. Until it sort of became that.
Yeah, but it was, if you watch the first season or two, like even the first season, there was rarely as many puns from the Crypt Keeper.
Fun fact, John Cassier, voice of the Crypt Keeper,
yeah,
married to Julie Benz for a long time.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That is a weird fun fact. That's odd.
Tonight from the Crypt of, yeah, Julie Benz.
But yeah, there's no Tales from the Crypt anymore. But like, if you watch the first season, it's not, yeah, as good as the...
Hello.
Hi. Hey, how's it going?
Hi, I'm Jonah.
JJ, pleasure.
Chris.
Nice to meet you. Yeah, see you. Pleasure, good to meet you.
Thank you for coming in.
It is an honor.
We're already recording, so...
Dear God.
Yes, it's already happened.
You don't screw around.
No, we don't...
Well, we're out of time, but it's been nice.
I turn my phone off, so...
So we don't get the dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee.
The Morse code.
Jonah and I were just nerding out about Creepshow 2, and then Tales from the Crypt, and how no one does a good horror anthology movie anymore.
Or show. Or,
it's going to happen soon. I think that this discussion is in the air.
You think so?
Yeah, there have been a lot of discussions about this.
Oh, it's great.
I hope so, because like so many of those movies defined so much of what I loved when I was a kid, and just gave us like really, especially now when people are used to like bite-sized chunks of stories because of short attention spans.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's true.
Why we don't have that?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, things are cyclical. I think it's, I'd love to see it.
Yeah.
Were you a Tales from the Crypt fan?
Sure. Yeah. I was a Twilight Zone fan, so
Twilight Zone,
to me was the anthology, but... You know, I loved Outer Limits when I was a kid, too, and Tales from the Crypt, you know, was a lot of fun.
It was more of a parody. It was serious the first season, then it became a parody unto itself.
It did. I mean, the Crypt Keeper was definitely, you know, as it went on, it more and more ridiculous. Like, sort of like what was scary at first suddenly became just
comical, all,
you know. I mean, but there's always a little bit of that kind of humor in it. But the idea of doing an anthology is something I'd love to see.
Because I would have assumed that you were a Twilight Zone fan, but I didn't have any idea until I walked in and saw the mold from Eye of the Beholder. Was that an actual mold from?
No, that was a mask that was made based on the William Tuttle makeup. But it was you know, one of my favorite episodes. Obviously, it's one of the classics.
Yeah,
it's great.
I almost kind of feel like, do they even still do Twilight Zone marathons anymore? Like, that was my favorite part of the year.
Thanksgiving, usually. So in a couple weeks.
It's 24 hours, right?
They do 24 hours. It used to be like Memorial Day and Labor Day on our, you know, our local channels that we do like the Twilight
Zone. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Memphis. Yeah.
Yeah, no, same thing here. But I think Sci-Fi Channel, does, I believe it's Sci-Fi Channel. But
I think so.
They do it.
Or AMC used to do it, I think. AMC?
Anyway, they do it. Yeah. You should typically do it on Thanksgiving.
And do you feel like, how much, do you ever, when you're working on stuff, do you ever go, I feel the influence of, you know, Rod Serling, or I feel this teleplay, you know, like sitting on my brain?
You know, he wrote, and as did a number of other incredible writers, notably, obviously, Matheson, but the work that they did on The Twilight Zone it's unbelievable the impact those stories continue to have on. I mean, you can trace so many movies back to ideas and you know themes and relationships and gimmicks and character turns or story reveals that were from that series. So it's not that I consciously think, oh, I want to try and use this moment or that moment, or you know, there are times when I think, oh, this reminds me of this or that. But you know, to me, that show was just it embodied the melding of incredible character and relatable and emotional characters with mind-bending, just fucking crazy good genre, you know, typically sci-fi, but it could be horror, it could be, you know,
supernatural.
It could be certainly supernatural, but a lot of times the mood of that show was something that I loved too. The kind of melodrama of it, that style, that really, you know, the fact that they didn't have all the money in the world to make those shows, that how sparse the sets were often. Right. There was a kind of like odd kind of impressionistic quality to the show that was part of the romance. And for that period of time, very short period of time, gratefully that they shot the show on video.
Mm-hmm. I remember
which
that.
Which is really weird because you watch it, it takes away from the, I don't know, the truth of it feels like a soap opera.
Yeah.
And it's really uncanny. But what's interesting, that there are things that I remember, there are episodes that were amazing that I remembered seeing as a kid and realized, oh my God, that was one of the video episodes. And when I would watch it, it was amazing how powerful some of the ideas were. And when you see the thing on video, it just was a very different feeling. So there was a kind of, it was the fact that it was filmed, the fact that it was filmed in that style, the fact that they used those kind of bare minimum sets. There was something about the whole thing that just made it the most magic cocktail for me.
Was that your biggest influence? Was sci-fi your biggest? Because I mean, if you look back at your earlier work, which was great, but like even your first stuff.
Let's be honest.
Okay, so Taking Care of Business, not a sci-fi.
And also maybe not great.
Although, how many puppeteers did it take to operate the character of Jim Belushi?
Yeah.
Oh no, Jim. He was a nice guy. he really was.
But there's definitely, you know, there's definitely an evolution. It was just sort of looking at like at where your writing is going. It's like, okay, take a break. Okay, regarding Henry. All right, mm-hmm. Cool. And then it just like starts jumping to these like really intense sort of sci-fi mind-bendy kinds of things.
Yeah, I mean, I always loved all sorts of stories. So I you know, like everyone, if the story's good, it doesn't matter what the genre is. I just happen to really love sci-fi. I loved, you know, as a kid, I was obsessed with all sorts of movies that were sort of genre movies, whether it was science fiction or horror or disaster movies. I was a big fan of, you know, the kind of classic Irwin Allen stuff. Mm-hmm. What's this? Oh, look, a table's coming in.
Table and some water.
We have stuff. Is this snacks.
And snacks. Snacks. Oh my God, I'm okay right now. People get mad at us when we eat on the podcast.
Oh, then
well, they're gonna have to fucking deal with it.
Then don't do this.
Crunch time.
Enjoy yourself.
Thank you.
No, but I gotta say, there's really not a kind of movie I didn't love. I remember being obsessed with the Universal monster movies when I was a kid. I love Frankenstein. Hunchback of Notre Dame was a huge movie for me as a kid. But, you know, whether it was the TV of the time, Twilight Zone, or the Planet of the Apes films, that whole series, I would buy the novels that, you know, were based on the movies that for Planet of the Apes. I loved, you know, as I got a little bit older, sort of 13, 14, I would sneak into R-rated movies, you know, the horror films of the time. As I got older, the slasher movies were, you know, I was obsessed with those. You know, so there really wasn't a kind of style or type of movie that I didn't love.
Yeah. Well, but just thinking about Twilight Zone and where, you know, where a lot of film is at now, no effects at all.
Sure.
And just mind-bendy stories could turn on a dime and then you'd be like, holy shit.
Yeah.
And I feel like so much of stuff we see now just relies on the holy shit moments of, look at that planet in the background, or look at that look at that laser gun, you know, or whatever.
Well, what's the episode where it's, you know, they're talking about getting out of, you know, getting out of town, or it's like something's coming, like their planet's going to explode, and then it turns out that they, you know, go to Earth.
And by the way, you know, I didn't realize until years later that Rod Serling was the one who wrote the screenplay for Planet of the Apes. And that twist at the end was very much like that.
Yeah.
Where you realize, oh my God, we've been here the whole time.
Yes. That, oh my gosh, I was wrong.
Right.
So, it was Earth all along.
So, you know, the Rod Serling influence is epic for me.
Yeah.
When did he die? He died in the 70s. Yeah, right? Because like he obviously did Night Gallery.
He did Night Gallery.
In the 70s. Yep. Which wasn't quite the same, but something about the color for, I don't know, there's something about it just lost.
No, it's true. But, you know, look, Steven Spielberg did the pilot with Joan Crawford, which is awesome, one of the stories. And, you know, the thing about Night Gallery, because they tried for a period, as you know, to do doing the Twilight Zone as an hour long.
Yeah.
And it didn't work, with a couple of exceptions. The hour was too long, and you think, if Rod Serling can't do that for an hour, no one can do that for an hour. And so I think one of the tough things about anthologies now is that a half hour is pretty much what you want to do.
Right.
And that's a tough thing, a half hour drama. It doesn't really exist in terms of TV and programming. All that's going to change, because the way people are watching TV now, when they want to watch it, where they want to watch it, and how they want to watch it, the traditional network decisions that are being made for you are going to become less and less relevant. But I do think that the Night Gallery model, which had a couple of different anthology stories, you know, in an episode, it wasn't always just one thing. You know, that was an interesting way to go. But my personal preference was the Twilight Zone.
And do you think these shows, like Twilight Zone, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Tales from the Crypt, like, do you think these work better when they have a figurehead, a host, to bring you into the story, to set up the premise?
I do think people need some kind of, you know,
something to
continuity.
Go back to.
Yeah. So you think, well, that's the way in. And clearly it's been done again and again in that way with Rod Serling and Hitchcock or The Crypt Keeper. But I think that
the three greats.
The three greats, please. The three geniuses.
What is C. Crypt doing now? Mm. What's he up to?
Secret?
But, you know, I do feel like that there are other ways to do it. And, you know, again, there have been a lot of discussions about this, and I can't imagine that a network is not going to try this soon on some level.
It's, you know, I hear a lot of, you know, a lot of people, like a lot of calls go out for people. It's like, we want a comedy version of those shows. But I don't think that, you know, it seems like there's, like, that's always fizzling.
Well, but as digital culture begins to, mm-hmm. as you see the eclipse begin to happen, where they kind of merge into one thing, digital culture, and we're doing one of those crazy YouTube channels. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we start to think, like, well, you know, when the delivery system becomes easy enough for most people to get this stuff on their television set, and they're not confused by how to get it, it's going to change the game.
I think that is already happening, and I know that when my kid watches South Park, he does it on his laptop.
Yeah,
you know, when my friends. We were just talking about this. Watch the, you know, the Mad Men. They watch it on their iPad. When it's this weird thing that it is becoming less and less relevant what the networks are wanting to do and how they want you to watch it, because the options are becoming increasingly, you know, available to just do it when and how you want to.
And do you feel like that there's a certain, that you have a crusade or a challenge as a filmmaker to try to, like, motivate people, like, no, you really need to go into the theater to see this. Don't watch it on your iPad later. Like,
watch it
in the theater now.
I do feel like it is a different experience. It is, you know, as bookstores and record stores and fill-in-the-blank stores disappear, there is you know, increasingly a kind of it's interesting. I think what's happening is that as things become more accessible and more effortless in terms of, you know, you want that album, you click that button that's not even a real button, and you have it, even though you can't see it or feel it. Mm-hmm. We're living in a time of sort of, you know, virtual existence, you know, paying for things with money you don't see to get something that you can't actually hold. and that feeling of, you know, having the record that you might not even actually listen to because it was such a breeze to get a hold of it, you know, in quotes, that you don't actually even take the time to listen to it. You just clicked it and you got it. Now you know you have it.
Yeah, unlike a time where you would go to a record store, buy it, bring it home, put it on, read the liner notes, look at the packaging.
It was an investment of time, not just money, but of time and experience.
Yes.
And when you got home with that album, it was evidence of something you'd gone through. There is now, except for maybe on a server somewhere, little evidence of anything that we're doing. So as bookstores and record stores vanish, you know, the communal experience of browsing, with the exception of clothes, I guess, or being in a restaurant and sitting in a place, movies are a communal experience. It is obviously wildly different being on the subway, looking at your iPad, watching an episode of, you know, or not an episode, but a movie that's come out. Than it is being at the theater and seeing it with people and having an experience. It's one of the reasons why, even though it's certainly not for everyone, movies like Paranormal Activity, while not really stories per se, they're sort of like a different kind of a story in a way, they are such experiences that you go and it's a ride. It's an amusement park ride. And you go and you see these movies or movies like it because it's a kind of... And I think that will always be, on some level, part of our, you know, DNA, sitting around the campfire hearing stories. There is something about the communal experience. It may be that watching the latest blockbuster at your house with your spouse or family or girlfriend or boyfriend, or whatever, and that may be fine. That may be great. I would argue that as good as, you know, TVs get at home, and as great as the sound system is, as large as you know, screens as we might have, it's more about being able to experience something as a human being with other human beings. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's going to be an increasing need and hunger for places for people to go to experience things in an authentic communal way.
I agree. I mean, but because I also...
That is the longest speech I've ever given.
No, but it's a great point because technology essentially... You know, our sort of addiction to convenience is isolating, and it forces us to I mean, like, it's funny. It's so dichotomous to me that we have these networks now of like, oh, I have 10,000 friends. I have 10,000 digital friends, but I'm sitting alone at home in my underwear.
That's right.
So I'm technically connected, but I'm actually still very much alone.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the result is, the net result of increasing isolation and increasing sort of virtual community. And it's funny because the very first Twilight Zone, the pilot with Earl Holliman is about...
Where is everybody?
Yes.
Yeah.
Being in that isolation tank and that whole experience of running through the city that's empty with evidence of people who are just there but just disconnected. And that notion of not being with anyone, you know, in a weird way... You know, we're all sort of getting, you know, closer to being alone in a booth with a thing. And I can imagine if you're in the hospital, if you're waiting for, you know, someone or something, if you're on an airplane, there are ways and places where it is a gift from God to have an iPad or iPhone. It's the greatest thing in the world. But any one of us can just stop and look at a sidewalk in a town or city, and you will see people walking elsewhere. They're just carrying their devices, and they're not present. And it is so crazy. I mean, I'm as guilty as anyone of this, but it is so crazy how often it's almost something out of like Brave New World, where you see these people who are in this kind of, you know, soma cloud. They're in this other place. They're doing something else, and they're just not in the moment. And you know, I get why it's so cool, and I enjoy my Angry Birds, and I have a good time communicating with people and watching and listening, and you know, and I use my iPhone for all sorts of things. I can play music on it. GarageBand on the iPhone is remarkable, actually.
Yeah, I love it.
It is unbelievable. It's unreal. I mean, it's insane. having said all that, it is a kind of curse that we are not appreciating the stuff that used to take some effort, that we are believing, like you say, we are surrounded by these friends that, you know, it's sort of demeaning to the term, friends, in a weird. I it's a very bizarre time.
Well, for me, just to sound like even more of an old person, like these goddamn kids, it's the idea of, I think part of it is that people are, just as a whole, people are freaked out, unhappy, overstimulated by the amount of stuff they have to process, and so they always have their face on their phone or their iPads because they are distracting themselves from their own thoughts.
Well, I would argue that that was always what life was. Not necessarily in terms of the stimulation that we're dealing with, but in terms of we're all here distracting ourselves until we die.
Like, yeah.
There's a little bit of that anyway. Yeah. But the thing that's so crazy is, and again, it kills me when I do this, and I know I'm sure I do it as much as anyone, but that idea that you're with someone, talking to someone, and your phone makes a little vibrating sound, and you just look away, there's so little respect left for being in the moment. And it's not to say if someone that you love is, you know, in trouble, if you know that there's you're waiting for an important call, of course there are always exceptions, but the rule has become that elsewhere and other takes precedent over here and now. Mm-hmm. So I'm talking to you and I'm like, oh, what's the... not because I know that my friend is, you know, at the doctor's and might need to get picked up or whatever, but because, oh, well, what else is there? And that's the scary thing, that there's a kind of assumption that there's going to be a more important thing on the phone than in front of you.
How do you even have time to be distracted by GarageBand?
You know, when you have three kids and, you know, you sort of like the it's funny, my five-year-old is obsessed with music. And so the idea, you know, I take him to school every day. And so, you know, we'll actually have 15 minutes sometimes after we get to school before we have to go in. Mm-hmm. Because if you must know, the first two kids get dropped off earlier. Anyway, so I'll sit there.
I just figure they didn't go at all.
Exactly. You know, nor are they homeschooled. But the youngest, you know, we'll just play music. And it's incredible how good it sounds, how effective it is. I like it more on the iPhone than the iPad in a weird way. It's very strange how good it is. I'm kind of amazed that it exists at all, you know.
Yeah, no, it's an incredible app.
But I want to delve a little bit into your work and just sort of starting back the Taking Care of Business movie. You were in college, right? You sold that right out of college?
I was during my senior year. Joel Mazursky and I sold the treatment of that movie to Katzenberg, who at the time was head of Disney.
So when you look back at your career, there are obviously like key bump points where you go, ah, this thing exploded and led me to this. That was certainly a moment.
It was insane. I mean, to be in college, and it was Christmas break. I knew I had to figure out what the hell I was going to do. I was at a mall buying Christmas presents, and I was leaving, and Jill, who I knew a little bit, was going up the escalator as I was going down, and I saw her and went back up. We started talking, and she was, you know, a couple years older than I was, and had sold a couple things, movies and stuff. And I just thought, I am grabbing onto these coattails so hard. and I said, "Can we please write something together?" And she's like, "Sure." And Jill is the greatest, and she's the person who, no matter what happens, no matter what she's doing, she will always do anything for any. She's the most wonderful person. So Jill and I started writing this treatment together. We just came up with an idea about someone who loses their planner, their Filofax. This is, of course, in the age of pre-cell
phone. Philo what?
That's right. And so we wrote this treatment, and I thought, you know, whatever, we'll see what happens. Went back to finish my final semester of college. Her father, Paul Mazursky. Mm-hmm.
From Police Academy? Paul Mazursky do Police Academy?
No. He did An Unmarried Woman. He did Bob Carroll, Ted and Alice. He did Down Down Beverly Hills. He did Moon Over Parador. He did
those I know, but I'm almost positive there was a Mazursky name on the Police Academy franchise.
I'm 100% sure that that's not true. Although
I'm gonna say you know more about this than I do.
Let's check right now.
And this is another reason why arguments don't last as long as they used to.
If he had anything to do with those movies, I'm gonna be so
oh no, please! I hope I didn't just destroy one of your heroes.
No. I'm never gonna talk to him again. No, okay. Hold on. Let's see here.
What? He showed the world Hightower.
If you're right, I'm gonna be so embarrassed.
No.
Let's see. Here we go.
Remember when these arguments would go on for weeks? Like, we still have to figure out if he was actually a part of
that. That's why
they
started the Guinness Book.
Yeah.
Drunken bar arguments.
So do you think he was a producer of those movies or what?
I don't know. I thought I remember seeing the name Mazursky on those credits somewhere.
Hmm. No, mate, I saw a man with 200 bees for a beard. No, that was 500 bees.
Yeah, I don't think...
Is there anyone named that?
I'll just look at Police Academy. Let's do that. We're almost done with this. Let's see, Police Academy.
No, that's all right. Listen, I hope I'm a fucking tool with this information and that I'm wrong. For some reason, I just, as a kid, I watched...
Oh, yeah, it says here, you're a fucking tool.
Oh, shit, that's right, right on IMDb.
That, yeah, that's right.
You think they would take that off? I'm going to sue them like that woman who doesn't want everyone to know she's 40.
Okay, here we go. Oh, my God. Literally, the problem with the mobile versions of things, the menus.
The menus, yeah. Deep diving.
Oh, my God.
Like five menu navigations deep.
Yeah. Can I just look at everything at once?
Siri was...
was Paul
connect to the network.
Was Paul Mazursky in the Police Academy? You're a tool.
Are you serious?
Oh my God! This is why you thought that. Look at that.
Paul Maslansky.
Wow,
pretty close,
my friend. Half kudos.
It's a
half kudos. Rhyming kudos.
What do you think the last name someone said the name Paul Maslansky out loud? You must have thought I was a fucking moron. You're like. Police Academy?
No.
How about Unmarried Woman?
No, I should have known.
He does really good autographs, though, at Academy Con every year.
Police Academy. I'm going this year as Mahoney. What about you?
Yeah. Always Mahoney.
Really? Oh, next year I want to be Michael Winslow.
The time I went as Hightower, I got in a lot of trouble.
Hey, guys, there's a gun. Pew, pew, pew. Pew, pew. I'm so sorry.
Paul Maslansky.
A phenomenal and sometimes overlooked by the Academy director. So you were working with Jill Mazursky.
I don't even remember what we were talking about.
We were talking about how you got involved with
Jill Mazursky. So what happened was...
Jill Mazursky.
So Paul gave the treatment we wrote to Jeffrey Katzenberg, who ended up buying it. And we signed the contract on a Friday, the writer strike of 1988. Started on that Monday, and it lasted 6 months. So I finished college and then moved back to LA and moved in with my best friend, got an apartment, waited around, the Writers Guild strike ended, and we started working on the movie. And that was how I impossibly luckily transitioned from being a desperate college student to being a desperate screenwriter.
It is pretty insane, though, for your kind of first thing. Like, not only are you going to get to write that, it's going to get made. And there are going to be, Jim Belushi was a pretty bankable film guy in the 80s. And Charles Grodin, amazing.
It was really an amazing thing to do. And obviously, while not the greatest film of all time by any stretch, to be able to go to the set of a movie that you wrote was surreal and bizarre. And, this last weekend, they gave some honorary Oscars out, and Dick Smith got one, the makeup artist, and I was asked to speak for him there, which is great. But I got to see Arthur Hiller, who's the director of Taking Care of Business. And he's just this, he did like the Out of Towners and Love Story and stuff, but he was just such a sweetheart. And to see him, and, I feel very lucky that I got to, especially at that age, to get to work with anyone was kind of a miracle.
Did he also do Police Academy? I just think everyone did Police Academy. So jumping off from that, so now you're in the film business and you're working for a little while, and then you do. Let's jump forward to Felicity, because I'm curious about the gap between Felicity and Alias. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you go from? I mean, Felicity, people love the show, critically acclaimed show, and then how do you pitch a show that has, this insane conspiracy stuff and those plots?
Well, what happened was as a fan of genre stuff, and I had just worked on Armageddon while we were working on Felicity as well, so I sort of had just gotten a fix of doing sci-fi stuff, which was a blast, and went to do Felicity, which Matt Reeves and I created, and it was based on this idea that I had, and he and I developed it, and I wrote the script, and he directed the pilot, and it was a very sweet story that had literally no stakes whatsoever. It was so hard because when you got to episode 3, you're like, shit. There were no bad guys. There were no monsters. There were no,
it was about the monsters inside us.
Exactly. But literally, like, grades. was like the most. But there was, you know, there was no way to do a show that you know, there were no crimes, there were no, you know, legal cases or medical cases. A TV show typically needs a door that every week bursts open with burden that mm-hmm. the main characters have to hold, carry, and deal with and help people in a selfless way. I mean, it's sort of the model of a TV show is a condition in which characters can actually deal with stuff that's not just their own issues. Mm-hmm. College is only about your own issues. There was very little. I'm not saying we didn't do shootings at parties and and, you know, dramatic breakups and horrible, you know, stories of, you know, there were things that were substantial in it, you know, whether it was like, you know, everything from, you know, date rape to drug use. So there are all those kind of things that were where you need to go to find stories. And of course, there are things that in many cases, sadly, are relevant to that age. But typically, it was a very difficult thing to sort of come up with what's the thing every week to do. While we were working on that show, I remember I pitched What If Felicity Were a Spy?
Oh, that's awesome.
And I said it simply because I thought it would answer every problem I have, because she could go out on crazy missions, she could be in insane chases and fight scenes and be sneaking around, the stakes would be literally life and death for the world, and she'd come back and no one could know what she was really doing, and she'd still have the issues of Ben or Noel or whatever the things we were dealing with. And everyone looked at me like I was insane. I wasn't really serious, but I was looking for something to make that show easy in terms of finding ways to tell stories easier. Anyway, around that time, ABC, Touchstone at the time, came to me and said, you know, we're looking to do a show that's a young female driven show. Would you have something? And I was at lunch with Boyd Braun, who's the head of the studio. Anyway, I said, look, I have this idea about a young woman who's a spy who's in grad school, you know, and I kind of like propose What If Felicity, because I know you can't in episode 16 say, and Felicity's a spy. You can't, you
right.
know. And they said, that sounds great. Why don't you write it? And so I just put the Run Lola Run soundtrack on and listened to it nonstop and wrote.
No!
It's the greatest. And I wrote the Alias pilot to that score, and I turned it in, and they said, who do you want to direct it? And I heard myself say, me. And they said, okay. And I thought, they're crazy. And we, you know, we cast the show with Jen Garner, who had been on Felicity and among others. So it was fun.
Wow. No, the Run Lola Run thing makes a lot of sense now, because for some reason, every once in a while when I'm driving down the street, the fucking theme to Alias hits me in the head. And I just hear, like, what's happening?
I'm sorry. I apologize. Yeah. Which, by the way, it's funny because that theme and the Lost theme, I wrote both of those in the mixed sound mixes because we needed a theme.
Yeah.
And I had my laptop, so I just did whatever I had to do, thinking they'd be temporary stuff.
Yeah.
And then getting to play, I thought, yeah, screw it. Let's just leave it.
Yeah.
So anyway, it was a fun thing to do. The Lost theme, by the way, is one note.
Right.
For which I won an ASCAP award. You know? Whenever I've done more than one note, I've won nothing.
See, in your acceptance speech, you could have just done that note.
Or just like, thanks. Just like, give one word.
What can be said?
No, I was a huge Lostie.
Oh, right.
Went way down the rabbit hole. Like, yeah, I would follow all the Easter eggs. Like, oh, there was a reference to the Hanzo Corporation in a commercial. I'm going to go online and deep dive and see all this crazy, you know, alternate reality stuff.
Thank you.
Season 4, there was the whole guy looking for his wife that was lost on another plane. There was the whole web series. I went down that. Spent so much time.
I mean, that was one of the. I think what was so exciting about that show is that so few shows kind of put you in an emotional place where you immediately call your friends afterward and go, what the fuck just happened? What did they do?
I gotta say, I mean, that was really all Damon. You know, he and Carlton Cuse both ran the show for the 6 years. And so, like, frankly, when I went to go do Mission Impossible and then Star Trek and being able to watch the show and have that same exact reaction you just had and to know, like, wow, I got to be part of that at the beginning, but literally they should and must and do take full responsibility for all that stuff. And I'm so happy that, you know, I got to, it's almost like having a kid where it's like you know you were involved in a fairly critical part of the experience, but at a certain point what they do, who they are, is sort of their choice. And I gotta say that for those moments in seasons 4 and 5 and 6, you know, that stuff that they did that I thought, whether it was all on the show or online sometimes too, was so brilliant. Even the Comic-Con appearances they did and the way they would sort of perform there. And
all the Paul Scheer stuff.
They did amazing work.
Yeah. Damon's been on the podcast before. What an aggressive guy.
Damon?
Like he hit Damon. Hit punch Jonah in the throat.
Yeah. Well, you know, some people deserve that.
I did. I'm not saying I didn't, but Damon was like, a little too hard.
Damon's like one of the sweetest guys in the world.
And awesome. Yeah.
And then so we did a comedy show at the UCB that was all Lost-based for the last episode of the show.
Yeah, that's fun.
And we all did these sketches, and I did a sketch as...
Are you a member of the UCB?
Not officially, but we do a lot of... We did a lot of shows there before we opened our own little.
Are you friends with Ben
theater.
Schwartz?
I know all these guys. So we did a fun Lost themed comedy show at the end, and Damon and Carlton came out and sat in the front row,
and they were great.
It was really fantastic.
That's awesome. That
was fun. Remember when Gaston at Meltdown put together the Dharma bunker?
Yes.
Did you ever go swing by
that? That was awesome. Amazing.
Meltdown's where our space is. That's where we do all our live comedy shows.
Right on.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So we have a Dharma desk there.
That's fantastic.
So from all that, even at this point, your things are pretty cooking for you. And then someone says, "Hey, do you want to do Star Trek?" I mean, that's how do you fucking wrap your mind around that?
Well, you know, it's I was frankly, and I know that this may not be your what you want to hear, but I was never really a fan. I never really got it.
Yeah,
I never really cared much about it. Most of my friends who loved it were, without question, smarter than I was, and I always thought. Well, I kept trying because I wanted to sort of figure out what, and I couldn't get it. I didn't care about it. It felt stilted, and it's ironic because a lot of the kind of tone and techniques and some of the writers as well were from the Twilight Zone. When you watch it, you go, God, there's that same kind of melodramatic vibe. A lot of the writers were the same you know writers, and you'd think someone who loved the Twilight Zone as much as I did would kind of find a kinship to that show and get on board. I couldn't do it. And so I enjoyed, you know, the movies that I saw, the early films, but I never looked forward to them. So when I was mixing Mission Impossible 3, which was the real shock for me that someone, namely Tom Cruise, would give me an opportunity to, to make direct a movie, when I was asked if I was interested in producing a Star Trek movie, when I said yes, it was because I'd never thought of it, ever. But what occurred to me as I was being asked was there is a version of it that I could see getting interested in. And it was weird because I couldn't tell you what that was. I just knew that if Star Trek were done in a certain way with a kind of, you know, an approach that somehow let me in more...
Mm-hmm.
And it was almost like I was actually being given the opportunity to at least attempt to do something that I wished had existed for me as a kid trying to get into it, which is a way in, which is an emotional way in that was not about the Enterprise or Starfleet or the Prime Directive or any of that stuff. That was completely emotional. I thought if that existed, I probably would have found a way in. Now, maybe I saw the wrong episodes. Maybe I wasn't in the right frame of mind as a kid. I don't know what it was. I've since... watched a number of them and actually have come to really appreciate the show.
I still try it. I can't.
It's funny because I would imagine a lot of Star Trek fans would be like, what the fuck? How can you? But I do appreciate that your sincerity. I'm like, no, I really did try. Yeah. And for whatever reason, I just couldn't connect with it. So here's what I...
But that's
what
I like. I love the movie. I thought it was great. And like, you know, I was, you know, it was a big event movie and a lot of my friends were going. So I was like, you know, I don't know the show, but you know it because it's just so much a part of the culture. At this point, you know, and then I saw it, and I was worried about not being in on stuff,
right.
Or you know, but there was a couple of those where someone would show up and people would go, but it still was like, well, you know, clearly I know that's the guy that arc, you know, that character archetype. And,
well, because I saw the movie with a guy named Will Wheaton who was on Star Trek: The Next Generation, and Will is
Will did a couple of voices in the movie.
Oh, he did, yeah. So Will, you know, we went and. I think he was kind of prepared to be like, all right, let's see what you got. And we walked out of it, and he was like, holy fuck. Like, he fucking...
No, he was very sweet. I got to say, the you know, doing that movie, the reason I wanted to direct it is because I thought, when in the world, ever, am I going to get a chance to do a space movie? Like, that's kind of...
Right.
That's cool. And I really loved the script that Alex and Bob wrote, and I thought, there's a version of this movie that is sort of surprisingly... intimate and emotional and about these two men who were kind of displaced, kind of both orphans in a weird way. and they find a family. And I thought, that's kind of a cool story. It happens to be called Star Trek. Mm-hmm. That happens to be Kirk and Spock, but cool. And casting that movie was, you know, tough, but a crazy joy to find that amazing cast. And so the whole experience was sort of bizarre in working on something that I never in a million years thought I'd be associated with, doing it with people that I would have loved to work with in any capacity, getting to do things that feel like in the kind of cliche things as a kid filmmaker you want to do, you know, spaceships flying through, you know, huge things crashing in, planets explode. I mean, stuff that you could only dream of yeah. doing. So it ended up being, oddly, of all things, kind of a this sort of dream project. And the weirdest thing was, as a kid, my parents knew Nick Meyer, who directed the two of the movies, and the sort of famously the best one, which is Wrath of Khan. Mm-hmm. And when I was bar mitzvahed, Nick Meyer came to my bar mitzvah, and I remember he was there. He'd come over for dinner, and he and I used to make like tapes all the time, like sort of like radio shows, you know, mm-hmm. as a little kid.
I did the same thing.
Nick Meyer and I did a show together. Like he came to my room and we like did it. And he was like the sweetest guy, and I still have the you know annotated Sherlock Holmes book he gave me for my bar mitzvah.
Holy shit!
And so years later, he actually you know directed a Star Trek movie, and then years later, so did I. So it's strange to, you know, have kind of had this sense of, you know, seeing that movie he did and realizing, oh my God, I hadn't seen him in years at the time, but oh my God, that was that guy my parents used to know. And so I always sort of felt this weird, I don't know, the connection to Star Trek to me was always through like appreciating that my friends loved it, knowing someone who'd been involved in it, never, ever, ever thinking I would be involved.
Yeah. I think it's a real feat because you run a serious risk with hardcore Star Trek fans by basically just redefining the timeline of the series and, you know, like, and blowing up Vulcan, you know, like all these things. And I feel like I didn't really talk to that many people who were like, what the fuck? You know, everyone was like, well, here's the thing, it was pretty good.
I think the key to that was, first of all, it was one of those things that not everyone even cares about or understands the timeline of it all. But the notion that when this one character, Nero, arrives in his ship, that basically the timeline is altered at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So everything forward is essentially an alternate timeline.
Yeah.
That's not to say that everything that happened in the original series doesn't exist. And I think as a fan of, you know, movies and shows, if someone told me the beloved thing for me was gone, I would be upset. But we didn't do that. We're not saying that what happened in that original series wasn't good, true, valid, righteous, and real. Like, let people embrace that. We're not rejecting that. That, to me, would have been the big mistake. We're simply saying that at this moment, the very first scene in the first movie, everything that people knew of Star Trek splits off into now another timeline.
Doc Brown does a very perfect explanation of that in Back to the Future 2. With the,
on this line here, yeah, and then it splits off so that exactly the Biff, you know.
Yeah. There you go.
So in that other place, there's still Tannen Estates and everything.
Yeah, like exactly. Yeah. So I want to glide in. I want to glide into the end of the into the chat. Talk about Super 8.
Yeah.
Which I loved, and it, like, the monster part of it was really cool, but I was so also into the sort of Stand By Me-esque element of it. The sort of, like, it really, it felt like, and I mean this in the best way possible, it felt like an Amazing Stories, like the Amazing Stories I watched when I was a kid. Like, oh my God, there's so much heart to it, yeah. But then there's also a crazy sci-fi element, too.
Right, that's nice. Well, thank you. I mean, you know, the thing about Super 8 was it began as a Stand By Me-type movie, and I think, you know, maybe was never completely figured out even in the script, the balance of those two things. It's somehow the idea of a movie that was just about a community, about kids, about their relationships, about first love, about being, you know, a parent, all that stuff. That was, in a weird way, one story, and then there was a kind of another thing that I don't know if it was ever fully integrated, those two notions. And yet, for me, the monster, gave me the kind of a little bit of a sort of raison d'etre for the movie to kind of call people to the theater to say, here's some spectacle. I'm all for the spectacle being in the eyes of an actor and a performance and speeches and conflict and character. But there was something about that where I just lit up inside and thought, that's a movie I want to make.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd had a separate idea of an alien that escapes from a train car being transported from Area 51, and the idea of I had no characters to speak of, and I simultaneously had this sort of cast of characters, making movies and kids and issues and loss and all that stuff, but I didn't have a story. It sort of answered both questions for me, and I combined them, but, you know, I spent many hours in this room, there are whiteboards all around the room, and all the, you know, trying to break the story and figure out, like, you know, how to make it work before shooting, after shooting, during editorial. And I do hear you that there are kind of two ideas that coexist. My wife would say, you know, can't you just make it about the monster? I'd be like, oh, don't say that. You know, I love the monster. But I do believe that there probably was a version that was just about these characters that might have been more true to that world. And yeah,
the monster stuff was cool.
Well, I love the idea of saying, here are kids essentially making a monster movie that basically find themselves in a monster movie.
Right. And not only that, but there's this weird meta thing that's going on in the movie where it was place in 79.
Yep.
So it takes place in 79.
Before Alien.
But I have a Nostromo patch. I have a patch from the actual Nostromo suit.
That's awesome.
I'm sorry. There was unnecessary information. But anyway.
The meta thing.
The meta thing is that those kids were a movie that would have been made in like 79, like back when they would cast these really great characters, like any like the Bad News Bears type movies, where you would just see, all of a sudden see these really great kid characters, which felt totally real, and not like those are kids acting. Like these kids were fucking great.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, no, they were amazing to work with. The whole group was fantastic and funny and real. It was amazing how many kids we saw, and when you see those kids, you know, a lot of those kids were these professional kids, and they'd come in with this bizarre cocksure attitude, and like, you know, okay, so how do you want it?
And you're like, you're not allowed to talk like that.
I don't know, maybe I
was studying abroad. What?
You know, it really was wild, and it was like, you know, maybe like someone your age, I don't know, like try it as a human being.
I don't understand.
Don't act like you can order your parents around.
No, but it really was amazing how...
Do you have a smoke?
It was hard to find kids that just felt like, oh, those are actually authentic children. And that was the key. And I really wanted kids that were just at the precipice of everything changing, where, you know, pre-voice changing and puberty hitting hard and get really serious boy-girl issues, where it was really in that kind of last moments of innocence. In fact, 3 weeks maybe after we stopped shooting, I wanted to reshoot a couple little things, and I called the kid who plays the director, Riley, and his voice had dropped, you know, an octave. Whoa. And I thought, this is a disaster, you know. And in fact, some of the stuff that we ended up reshooting, which we shot a lot of it in this building, tons of it in this room.
Oh, sweet.
One of the scenes that we shot in this room, and there are many, was the scene where they're watching TV, you know, the next morning after the crash, and Charles, you know, realizes they can use the train crash in his movie.
Production elements?
Production value.
Yeah.
And the reason in the scene, at one point he whispers, you know, oh my God, Joe, we can use it. And he's whispering because his voice was about 2 hours.
Oh, shit. Yeah. That's rad.
Yeah. I had to have him whisper it. I was like, you can't talk.
So when you're building this story, like when you're writing, what's... Do you do outline first, or do you do story ideas? Do you try to pull everything together? What's just really quickly, like, what's your process?
You know, what I'll usually do is just start writing ideas for scenes and moments and things that I know, character relationships, just the stuff that I feel is, you know, the broad strokes of what I know want to be there, kind of the gross motor function stuff. and then Jay and Jonah
just had a moment.
and then, you know, it's about things like, well, how do you structure that? Like, what are we building to? Where would these particular moments want to happen? And then as it goes, it really is a question of just sort of talking it through, whether it's to myself or to Steven, who is amazing to work with during the process of development, structuring the script.
Did you find yourself in a poltergeist situation ever?
In which way?
Where they move the house, but not the heads. They just move the headstones, but not the
grave. Just where it's,
swimming with a bunch of...
when a tree attack you at any time?
Peeling your face off in a mirror?
When the ghost is in the bed?
When Zelda Rubinstein comes over?
Yeah. No, just like I heard when, you know, the whole story of, you know, when during Poltergeist, he was kind of like very involved in...
I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
No, I mean...
It's more of a passing joke.
No, I didn't know what you meant, because I thought you were talking about how quickly Steven wrote the script, because he wrote Poltergeist, he wrote it in 5 days. The thing about working with Steven that was, you know, amazing, first of all, you know, it's very surreal to work with a person who was sort of your idol all through your childhood. And I don't care how old you are, I think you always sort of feel like you're 12 or 13, 14. So to work with Steven was unbelievable on every level. I would have loved for him to have been more involved in the actual production of the movie. Unfortunately, he was shooting War Horse, so we were both on our sets, and we would talk every day and email all the time. And but, you know, he came to the set, I think, 3 times, and every single time, I had the insane, impossible luxury of looking at Steven Spielberg in the eyes and saying, what would you do with this? And and have him say, you know, well, you know, it'd be cool to do a shot over there, like, you know, and you'd just be like, that's cool.
WWSSD.
It is cool.
You have those moments where you're talking to him and he's like, well, JJ, I really think you should do this, and then you go, okay. Also, you're fucking Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, there was a little bit of that. But the truth is, you know, when you work with someone even like Steven, you know, who is so kind and so giving enough, it becomes simply a collaboration, but then you cannot help but have these moments where you're just slapping yourself, and, you know, in your head, you're in shock that you're actually getting to work with him at all. And so he was just the greatest. And including, by the way, when I had a cut of the movie after having worked on it for a while and knowing we had 2 weeks left to turn over the final cut and knowing it was nowhere near what it needed to be and, you know, freaking out and all that stuff that goes with post-production. And I was in this room with him, and it was, you know, on a Saturday, and I never, because of the kids, you know, never work on weekends. And it was like an exception because we had no time. And Steven came over, and we just sat here for hours talking. We watched a big chunk of the movie that we knew was problematic. And we, on the whiteboards here, just listed all the scenes, and we worked on reordering a bunch of things and changing things, and we can control the Avid from in here, and we recut it and then watched it again. And it was the most amazing thing to be with him.
Oh, my God.
Because to hear him say, you know what I would do? You're like, what, Steven Spielberg? You know, it was really an awesome thing.
No, I don't know what you would do, please.
Me too. Yeah, exactly. The same thing. Exactly. You.
How did you know that was exactly what I was thinking?
Well, I know you got to go, but thank you so much for spending time with us. And I do want to say the Super 8 DVD, it's DVD, Blu-ray, and digital download now, which I totally dig that.
Like, yeah.
The three punch.
Yeah. It is good. I agree.
That's coming out Tuesday, November 22nd.
Indeed.
So that'll be available. Pick that up for the holidays. Give it to your man. It's a fun movie. I love Super 8.
Yeah,
so thank you so much, and thank you for letting us come here. And we're probably going to nerd out on stuff that you have here on the way out.
Yeah.
Just all of your props.
The credit plate thing from the Twilight Zone.
That was insane.
That's insane.
Oh my God!
I saw your bust of Simon Pegg, and I emailed him before I came here, and I was like, I'm doing with the podcast with JJ. And I go, is he nice? Is he going to punch me in the face? And he just said, don't look him in the eye.
I love that guy. I got to tell you, he's amazing in Mission. The one that Brad directed, but I will say that looking forward to Star Trek, working with Simon is one of the things I'm most looking forward to. I could not have more fun.
Yeah, he's a nice guy.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he's cool.
Certainly doesn't come off as like one of the biggest comedy stars in the world.
He's just the greatest. I love him.
So. Well, thanks, man. It was a pleasure to meet you.
Oh, my pleasure, man. Thank you very much.
Thanks for hanging out.
Thank you so much. Burrito, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast was brought to you by Saints Row the Third. Steelport is yours now on Xbox 360, PlayStation 3, and PC.
Once upon a beat! Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondry and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me,
DJ Fuge,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondry Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.